Good morning. It's good to see everybody this morning. We're going to continue our series, Real Parenting. And you know, last week we talked about raising daughters. And this morning we're going to address the subject of raising sons. And you know, boys are a different breed, aren't they? I was talking with a friend of mine last night who has a daughter, no sons, and two granddaughters and one grandson. And she was just talking about how aggressive her little grandson was as compared to the little girls and her own daughter. And boys are just different. What would cause a boy to go as fast as they can on anything that rolls? Or boys, what would cause them to roll? Go as fast as they can on anything that rolls. What causes little boys to stick beans in their ears? What causes boys to get on a trampoline and jump over doing backflips over and over and over till they're so dizzy they catch the edge and break their leg? What causes a little boy to hurdle off a dirt bank, break his leg, but think it's nothing and continue to ride his bike for a few more hours before finally deciding he might need to have his leg looked at? Why would a lad find a pair of handcuffs, at our church no less, real handcuffs, put them on knowing that he doesn't have the key, go to that his mom has to take him to the sheriff's department? You should see the looks on their faces to get them undone. What would cause a little boy to think he's George of the Jungle, grab a vine, hurtle across the bank with no idea what's on the other side, and break his nose? What causes boys to build a luge out of a skateboard, hurtle down an asphalt hill as fast as they can go, probably reaching speeds of 30 miles an hour, with no helmet and no possible way of stopping? And those are just my boys. Just some of the things they've done. James Dobson tells a great story in his book, Raising Boys. And it's done in the first person in the book. This is what it says. He says, "I am blind, and as a kid, sometimes I played with other kids, other blind kids, and we always found just as many or more ways to get in trouble as sighted boys. Like the time I was over at a blind friend's house and he took me in the garage to show me his older brother's motorcycle. We decided to take it out for a spin. Two blind boys. Why not? We rode down the street feeling for the curb, and at each intersection we'd stop, turn off the engine, listen, and then cross. We rode all the way to the high school track where we could really cut it loose. First, we would pile up dirts at the edge of the track so we would feel the bump if we started to go off the track. Then we took off, going faster and faster and faster, having a blast. What we didn't know was that people were there trying to run or walk on the track for exercise, and they were trying to wave us off. We couldn't hear them over the roar of the motorcycle engine, and numerous times we almost ran somebody over. Eventually they called the police, who showed up and tried to wave us over too, but of course we didn't hear them either. Finally, they got their sirens and bullhorns going, and we stopped. They were furious and refused to believe that we were blind until we showed them our Braille watches and they escorted us home." You can't make that up. Any of you who've had boys, I'm sure, could tell your own stories today. In an article entitled, "What Are Boys Made Of?" reporter Paula Gray Hunker quoted a mother, Mackenzie, who said, "Raising her two sons is like living with a tornado. From the moment they come home from school, they'll be running around the house, climbing trees outside, making a commotion inside that sounds like a herd of elephants has moved in upstairs. I'll try to calm down, and their dad says, 'That's what boys do. Get used to it.'" And have you ever noticed that when boys do get hurt, that they don't really learn from their mistakes? They just chalk it up for bad luck, and then things will be different the next time. And besides that, every boy will tell you that scars are kind of cool anyway. These might be some of the reasons that they never wrote a song, "Thank Heaven for Little Boys." They don't inspire great sentimentality. So what do we do with these little aggressive machines that psychologist John Roseman called all afterburner and no rudder? You kind of ponder some of the things when you're thinking about boys, questions like, what makes them do that? Why do young males act like that? What inner force compels them to just teeter on the edge of disaster? What is it about the masculine temperament that causes boys to tempt the laws of gravity and to ignore the gentle voice of common sense that says, don't do that? Well, as we kind of dive in and talk about raising boys this morning, I want us to first and foremost remember that those of you who have boys like myself, I have three, God gave us boys. Boys that we are to parent into godly men. And he gives us these little fellows who have all the makings down deep inside to become unbelievable men. And he gives us the responsibility for the construction of that character. So this morning we are once again, as we've done oftentimes in this series, going to jump over to the book of Proverbs and just kind of take a lens, so to speak, and look at some selected passages. You know, the book of Proverbs is kind of advice from a father to a son. Some 40 times the term sons is used in the book of Proverbs. And so I want to look this morning, we're just going to look at five kind of areas of instruction that Solomon gives for raising boys. And again, kind of like last week when we talked about raising daughters, you'll notice there's some overlap. Some of this is not just stuff that goes toward boys, just like some of it last week was just not stuff that applies to daughters. It kind of intermingles. But here's the first thing we need to teach our boys. I believe this is even more prevalent today than maybe in years past. We need to teach our boys to stand alone. Over in Proverbs chapter 1, verses 10 through 16, there's some verses here that talk about standing alone. And I'm going to begin reading. It'll be on the screen behind me. My son, if sinful men entice you, do not give in to them. If they say, come along with us, let's lie in wait for innocent blood. Let's ambush some harmless soul. Let's swallow them alive like the grave and whole like those who go down to the pit. We will get all sorts of valuable things and fill our homes with plunder. Cast lots with us. We will all share the loot. My son, do not go along with them. Do not set foot on their paths, for their feet rush into evil. They are swift to shed blood. The writer is addressing sons here, and in effect he's saying, learn to stand alone. Do you know our boys are under relentless pressure, relentless peer pressure to just follow the crowd? To do what everybody else is doing? And we need to teach them that it's okay to stand alone, to stand your ground, to be the only one that's taking the path if that's what's required. I want you to notice three commands. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here this morning, but it says, do not consent in verse 10. Verse 15, it says, do not walk in their way. And it also says in verse 15, keep your feet from their path. It's basically saying, follow the path, God's path, even if you have to follow it by yourself. Over in Proverbs 13:20, it says, walk with the wise and become wise, for a companion of fools suffers harm. Teach your boys to stand for what is right. I think most everybody in here recognizes the name of Tim Tebow. The year after he won the Heisman Trophy, and he was the first sophomore to ever win the Heisman Trophy, Tim Tebow, quarterback, Florida State. He's now a minor league baseball player. He made sure that his name was withdrawn for the Playboy All-American team. He didn't want any part of that. Only a few men have ever done that. A few young men have said, you know what? It might be an honor, but I don't want that kind of honor associated with my name. And he received a lot of criticism for that. A lot of people say, well, he just Mr. Goody Two-Shoes and that kind of thing. And only a few other men have done that. Danny Werfel, for one, who was also a Florida State quarterback. David Pollock, who used to play for the University of Georgia. A gentleman by the name of Wesley Britt, who used to play for the University of Alabama. Listen to what Wesley Britt said when they selected him. He said, initially I was like, heck yeah, I'm going to take it. It's a great honor. But after thinking about it for a while, I decided this is not one of my goals. I put God first, and I set my goals for Him. I talked to God about it and felt it just wasn't the right thing to do. Then he went on, he says, it's like a retreat. He's talking about what goes on there. When you get to know all the other players, he said, I would have enjoyed getting to meet and know players from all across the country. But he said, then they take your picture and put it in a magazine where there are a bunch of nude women in it. And he said, I just didn't want to be a part of that. He went on to say, I speak a lot of times to kids at churches, and I try to be a leader and set a good example. And I think you do that by leading by example. And then the last sentence, he says, if I play the way I should, God will bless me. He has already blessed me with so much talent. I live my life for God, and He will lead me down the right path. Teach your young men to stand alone. How do we do that? A couple suggestions this morning. Help them to pick good friends. And we talked about the importance about that a lot last week with our daughters, but it also applies to our sons. Help him learn to evaluate his current friendships. Help him to consider the type of friends that he needs and needs to have. And also remember this, parents. Sometimes if you forbid friendships, you're liable to drive him to them rather than away from him. But friendships are so important. And then secondly, remind him the consequences of wrong. For children to understand, for teenagers to understand why they shouldn't do something, there's just that magnetic pull. For them to understand why they need to resist that magnetic pull, they need to understand the consequences of wrong and what would happen if they do that. So that's the first one, stand alone. Second one is this, teach them to be open to God's counsel. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 11 and 12. My son, do not despise the Lord's discipline and do not resent His rebuke. Because the Lord disciplines those He loves as a father the son He delights in. Do you realize when you look at Scripture, a tender heart toward God, a sensitive heart toward God is kind of a hallmark of manhood? You know, a lot of times we just think the men of Scripture, these big, burly men, and that's what our society, you know, men are, you know, real men. But when you look at Scripture, they're real men, they're manly men, but they have a sensitive heart. Think about somebody like David, a great king. He was a fierce warrior. Somebody described him, or the psalmist described him as like a mother bear with cubs and the fierceness of the way that he used to fight. I mean, he's just this absolute fierce warrior and great leader. But what else does Scripture tell us about him? And he was a man after God's own heart. He was sensitive to God. Contrast that with Samson. Samson was supposed to be this wonderful, great leader of the nation of Israel. That's what he was destined to be. But what is it we remember most about Samson? His hair, his strength, Delilah, and he committed suicide pushing some pillars in. He's supposed to be a great leader. We don't remember any of that because he never really was. He just kind of becomes this sad footnote in Israel's history. He's supposed to be a great leader because he wouldn't listen to godly counsel over and over in the three chapters that you read about him over in Samuel. So how do we develop sensitivity toward God in our sons' lives? First of all, teach him to respond to your counsel. If he responds to your counsel, your wisdom, your instruction, he's much more likely to respond to God's. And that starts when they're little, folks. We talk all about the discipline and those kind of things. Make sure. Secondly, help him to see the value of other people's correction. If he learns that when his teacher, who is authority over him, or his coach, or his employer, and others around him, he will naturally grow to respect God's correction. Folks, I don't know if you realize it, But we are raising a generation, or we've raised a generation that has been pampered, that has been told over and over how wonderful they are, that it's never their fault. It's the teacher's fault. It's the coach's fault. It's their boss's fault. It's the band director's fault. We've handed them ribbons for being participation ribbons just because they're average. Teachers pass them on to the next grade because they don't want to deal with their parents. And then we wonder, why do we have these kids that have no drive and no ambition and no work ethic? It's because they've never been held accountable for their behavior or their work. And they don't listen to instruction and they don't listen to correction. I'm not talking about everybody, of course. But I'm talking about a big percentage of young adults today fit this category. Teach your child to see the value and instruction from other people. Years ago, when I was still the youth pastor here, we had a combination class with an adult class. In fact, it was Pat Davis's class. Pat still teaches Sunday school here. And we had this kind of combination class, and we were talking about the importance of friendships and that kind of thing, and the adults were kind of teaching the youth that morning. And one of the youth was just insisting that he ought to be able to learn from his own mistakes, and he didn't need to listen to his parents because he needed to learn on his own. And one of the gentlemen in that class finally made a statement. I thought it was a very wise statement. He said, "Yeah, you can learn from your own mistakes, but that could be a pretty tough road to hoe." And I thought, you know, there's so much wisdom if that young man would listen to somebody else, that counsel. Teach your children that. Thirdly, share your life with him. Share your life with your boys. You know, I think sometimes we unintentionally communicate to our sons that, "Oh, man, I had it made. I had it all figured out. I didn't have any problems when I was a teenager." Well, we did, but we never tell them that. Share your life. Tell about the challenges that you had. Share the bad things that happened in your life as well as the good things. Share the negatives as well as the successes. He needs to hear that. Don't just put yourself up on a pedestal and make it sound like, "Oh, man, I had it all figured out, and what's wrong with you," kind of thing, because that's the attitude that sometimes comes across. Fourth, spend sufficient one-on-one time with your sons. You are not molding a tin soldier for a dime store. You are molding a man of God, and you have to spend time with them. Quality time and quantity time. That is critical. Third one, teach them how to deal with temptation. You know, it's interesting when you look at the book of Proverbs, it's 31 chapters, that it really kind of only deals with two temptations. Sexual temptation, and then food and drink are really the basic primary temptations that the book of Proverbs deals with. Proverbs 5, 1 through 6 says this, and again it'll be on the screen. "My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Turn your ear to my words of insight, that you may maintain discretion and that your lips may preserve knowledge." And he begins to talk about the adulterous woman. He says, "For the lips of the adulterous woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil." And then I want you to notice the results he starts talking about in verse 4. Because this is not the way the Hollywood movies portray adultery. Just listen to this description. "But in the end, she is bitter as gall, sharp as a double-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lead straight to the grave. She gives no thought to the way of life. Her past wander aimlessly, but she does not know it." That's a different description than is often portrayed to our young people, isn't it? Very rarely does anybody get pregnant in the movies, and very rarely does anybody get an STD. Very rarely do they show the emotional wreckage and the carnage emotionally that happens in affairs and adultery and premarital sex and those kind of things. Proverbs 6:20, "My son, keep your father's command and do not forsake your mother's teaching." Verse 24 of the same chapter, "Keeping you from your neighbor's wife, from the smooth talk of a wayward woman." So how do we teach our kids about this, about temptation? It's everywhere. Do we just say, "Hey, don't do that"? Will that work? Probably not. I think we have to go a little bit further than that. Number one, share with them how you kept from doing it or how you keep from doing it. What are some things that you have done in your own marriage to affair-proof your marriage? Let your sons know about that. How do you keep your mind pure? How do you handle temptation? How do you keep your mental energy directed in the right place? You need to share that with your sons. Don't let them just try to figure it out. I know sometimes those can be difficult subjects to tackle. But he's struggling with it. I was talking to Billy the other day, and he was telling me, pornography is just something that comes up all the time in the youth group now. Boys coming to him and just, I don't know how to handle this, what do I do, kind of thing. Talk to your sons about this kind of stuff. Secondly, make sure he learns the facts of life at home, because he's going to learn them somewhere. Wouldn't you rather him learn at home? Chuck Swindoll is a noted pastor and author, and he said when he used to do premarital counseling sessions, he would ask this question, well, what did your parents teach you about a biblical view of sex? He said he can count on one hand the number of times somebody would say, well, they taught me X, Y, Z. He said usually he was just met with a blank stare. They knew the facts of life, but they didn't learn them from their parents. Let them know that immorality starts in the mind. You know, there was a day when, you know, if you wanted to look at a bad magazine or something, you had to go find one somewhere. That's not the case anymore. The computers, the smartphones, all that kind of stuff, put filters on those kind of things, set up ways of blocking that kind of stuff, take the temptation away from them as much as you possibly can. Then the third one is this, teach him about women. Some of you guys are like, well, he's out of luck there. Moms, you might have to come into play here. Why are women different? Why are females different? Help your son to understand that. And then guys, certainly we have a role too. How do you treat women? How do you show them respect? Those kinds of things. Make sure you're teaching your boys about those kind of things. Because the world isn't. You know, women are a sex object in most everything you see. Teach your son that that's not an accurate portrayal of women. Teach him how, and a lot of that he's going to learn from example. Fourthly, teach him how to handle money. You know, our country is basically raising and has raised a bunch of financial illiterates. A recent group of high school seniors from all walks of life, in all economic areas of life, were given a 52-question test on financial stuff. The average score was 42%. That means out of 52 questions, most of them missed 27 or 28 questions. Most young people have no idea how interest works. They have no idea that when they sign those dotted lines when they're 18 years old, going off to college for those student loans, how that works and how they're going to pay it back. They just don't. You have to help them understand those kind of things. Statistics tell us that financial problems are one of the biggest reasons for divorce. Teach your kids about money. It'll help their marriage later on. Another statistic tells us that the average 65-year-old has $100 net worth. Teach your sons about money. Many people balance their checkbooks by whatever the bank statement says. They just write it in underneath at the end of the, they don't try to balance. Teach your children. What causes this financial illiteracy? Let's just paint a typical picture of a lot of homes. We'll call them the Wilsons. And the Wilsons have three children, Charity, Tyler, and Ryan. And pretty much they never talk to the kids about money. Because, you know, there's not a lot of it sometimes, and they don't want the children to be upset. And besides, a lot of times they use credit cards to cover things, and now they're paying a lot of interest that they can't ever get paid off, and that interest could really go to help their kids and help things around the house, but they're paying it all to credit card companies. And Mr. Wilson, you know, he goes to the bank, and he's cashing his check, and the kids don't really know what he's doing in the bank, and he gets in an argument about his mortgage payment being late, and then he comes out, and, you know, the kids don't know anything much about the bank except dad goes in there and gets money. And so he comes out, and Ryan's like, hey, can we go eat at McDonald's? And Charity's like, hey, I need a new outfit for school. And then dad just kind of blows his top because he's just been in an argument with the bank manager, and he just, you know, what do you guys, you think money grows on trees or something? And Tyler's the youngest. He's like, well, I don't know if money grows on trees. I'm not sure where it comes from, but, you know, they buy stuff. And our kids never make connections on, you know, that you pay to have cable and you pay for electricity and you pay for the house and all those kinds of things. Because we don't share with them and we don't teach them things. I'm not saying you have to tell them everything about your finances, but you need to let them know that this is how life works, and you pay bills and you work for money and those kind of things. And I think there's basically four areas that you need to share with them about. Number one is giving. They need to understand that giving ought to be a part of their life. You know, here at Burning Bush, there's three B's. There's be engaged, be transformed, and be generous, because we think it's really important, and Scripture teaches that we need to be generous. Teach your children to give early on. Even if it means you give them some money to put in the children's church downstairs. Even though it's not their money, it associates generosity. It associates, when I go to church, there's giving. Teach them to give some of their birthday money and their Christmas money. Not just to church. It can be to charities or helping other people or whatever. But teach them to give. Secondly, help them to understand that you have to earn money. It just doesn't come to you. You have to earn it. Thirdly, teach them about spending money. I mean, spending money wisely. People won't have any trouble spending money. But teach them to spend it wisely. Over in Proverbs chapter 31, where we were last week, you know, she was a wise person when it came to how she spent her money. Fourthly, teach them how to save. It's so important that they learn how to save. And the earlier they learn that, the better. And by the way, I meant to put this on the screen, but I forgot to. This is a book on financial parenting. If you're interested in getting the title of this book, I'll have it up here afterwards, and I'll be glad to share the title with you. It's by Larry Burkett and Rick Osborne. Excellent information in there about teaching your kids or your grandkids about money. And let me add this. Too much money early in a child's life will spoil a child. You know why? It will pacify him, and it will steal his will to achieve. Fifth one, last one. Teach him the value of hard work. Proverbs chapter 10, verses 4 and 5 says, "Lazy hands make for poverty, but diligent hands bring wealth. He who gathers crops in the summer is a prudent son, but he who sleeps during the harvest is a disgraceful son." In a nutshell, teach your son that hard work pays off. You know, most people understand that there's a lot of satisfaction in hard work, that there's joy in it, that there's a lot of life lessons that are learned when we learn hard work. All of you probably accomplished something that took a lot of effort. It was difficult. There's a lot of pride in that at the end. You know, some of the best lessons I learned about work and job and work ethic and those things was when I was young. I was 14 years old when I got a paper route. Had about 200 customers. I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, roll papers, put them on my bicycle racks, and then drive about 2 miles away to throw papers off of my bicycle. Then I'd come home about 6, eat breakfast, go to school. When I got home, we had an evening paper too back then. And I would do it all over again, roll papers, throw them off the bike, get home about 5:30, 6 o'clock. 365 days a year I did that. When I asked for the job, my parents made sure I understood, it's your job. If you want it, that's fine. I did that for about 2 years, my freshman and sophomore years of high school. You learn a lot of responsibility when you have to get up at 4 o'clock every morning. But you know, it didn't hurt me. Later on in high school, I had a job as working at an oil field welding company. And it's a totally different kind of job. Hot, dirty, greasy, filthy kind of work. Working with your hands. I learned a lot there too. You know, you just sweat and come home just covered in grease. Learned to work with your hands. Also learned that I probably needed to, you know, find something to do that was a little bit different than oil field welding, or I was going to starve to death. Wasn't very good at welding. But we need to let our kids learn the value of hard work. I mean, I understand the thought process that you want your kids to have it easier than you had it. I understand that. There's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes we forget it's the hardships and the difficult times of our life that have molded us into the people that we are. And if we go too easy, and I don't know where the line is in your family, but if we go too easy, they don't understand the value of hard work and how you arrive at where you're at in life. You know, a strange creature emerges when we tell our boys, don't worry about it. I'll cover it. Here's some money. Take the credit card. I'll pay for it. And that strange creature is a creature that is lazy and indifferent. Getting something for nothing prompts irresponsibility. You know, I've been teaching a men's class at Burning Bush on Wednesday nights here. We call it men's fraternity. I don't know, 10, 12 years. In that class, from time to time, we'll get into subjects like, what did you learn from your dad? And anytime we get into that subject, one, two, three guys, people in that class, somebody will always say, I learned hard work from my dad. I learned the value of hard work from my dad. I learned a day's pay for a day of hard work. That always comes up. Nobody ever says, man, I wish my dad wouldn't have taught me about doing hard work. They never say that. But they always say it with pride and affection about their dad. My dad taught me to work hard. And they say it with pride in their voices. That's what we want to teach our boys. Teach them the value of hard work. Standalone reviewing. Godly counsel. Dealing with temptation, the value of money, and the importance of hard work. Those are things that our boys need to learn. There's lots of other things, but those are the five things that we've highlighted this morning. And then I want to end with this. It's a little bit sentimental, but it is graduation Sunday. It's a poem called It's Tough on a Dog by Gene Sartell. It's tough on a dog when his boy grows up, when he no longer romps and frolics like a pup. It's tough on a dog when his boy gets old, when they no longer cuddle on his bed when it's cold. It's tough on a dog when his boy gets tall, when he's off with the boys playing soccer and baseball. They no longer paddle through the mud and the bog, hoping to find a stray turtle or frog. They no longer run through the grass on their knees, or roll in piles of fresh fallen leaves. It's tough on a dog when his boy gets tall, when he's off to school looking at girls in the hall. It's tough on a dog when he has work to do, when he forgets to play as he used to. It's tough on a dog when instead of the woods or fields or pond, his boy becomes a man, and the man is gone. Would you pray with me, please?